Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, October 22nd, 2023. My name is Bill McCann, and I'll begin with a section talk, which is always where David Marchese interviews people. This is a hospice nurse on embracing the grace of dying. A decade ago, Hadley Louse was lost. She was a young single mother searching for meaning and struggling to make ends meet while she navigated nursing school. After earning her degree working in immediate care, she made the switch to hospice nursing and changed the path of her life. Flouse, who was 31, found herself drawn to the uncanny, intense, and often unexplainable emotional, physical, and intellectual gray zones that come along with caring for those at the end of their lives, areas of uncertainty that she calls the in-between. That's also the title of her first book, which was published this summer, The In-Between, Unforgettable Encounters During Life's Final Moments, is structured around her experiences, tragic, graceful, earthy, and at times apparently supernatural, with 11 of her hospice patients, as well as her mother-in-law, who was also dying. The book has so far spent 13 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. It's all been very surprising, says Louse, who, despite her newfound success as an author and her 2 million-plus followers on social media, still works as a hospice nurse outside in New Orleans. But I think that people are seeing their loved ones in these stories. And David asks, what should more people know about death? I think they should know what they want. I've been in more situations than you could imagine where people just don't know. Do they want to be in a nursing home at the end or at home? Organ donation? Do you want to be buried or cremated? The issue is a little deeper here. Someone gets diagnosed with a terminal illness, and we have a culture where you have to fight. That's the terminology we use, fight against it. So the family won't say, do you want to be buried or cremated? Because those are not fighting words. I've had situations where someone has wanted to be buried or cremated. I've had situations where someone has had terminal cancer for 3 years and they die, and I say, do they want to be buried or cremated? Because I've told the funeral home I'd call, and the family goes, I don't know what they wanted. I'm like, we've known about this for 3 years, but no one wants to say, you are going to die. What do you want us to do? It's against the culture of, you're going to beat this. Is it hard to let go of other people's sadness and grief at the end of the day at work? Yeah. There's this moment, especially when I've taken care of someone for a while, where I'll walk outside and I'll go fill up my gas tank, and it's like, wow, all these other people have no idea that we just lost someone great. The world lost somebody great, and they're getting a sandwich. It's a strange feeling. I take some time, and mentally I say, thank you for allowing me to take care of you. I really enjoyed taking care of you because I think that they can hear me. The idea in your book of the in-between is applied so starkly. It's the time in a person's life when they're alive, but death is right there. But we're all living in the in-between every single moment of our lives. She says, we are. So how might people be able to hold on to appreciation for that reality, even if we're not medically near the end? It's hard. I think it's important to remind ourselves of it. It's like you read a book and you highlight it, but you have to pick it back up. You have to keep reading it. You have to, until it really becomes a habit to think about it and acknowledge it. David says, I was reading these articles recently about how scientists are pursuing breakthroughs that could extend the human lifespan to 120. And of course you can't. That's some part of people that thinks they can cheat death. And of course you can't, but what do you think about the prospect of extending the human lifespan? I don't want to live to be 120. I've spent enough time around people who are close to 100, over 100, to know that once you start bearing your children, you're ready. Personally, I've never met someone 100 or older who still wants to be alive. I have this analogy that I did a TikTok on. This is from having a conversation with someone over 100. And her feeling is that you started with your earth room when you were born. You have your parents, your grandparents, your siblings. As you get older, your earth room starts to have more people. You start making friends and college roommates and relationships. Then you start having kids. And at some point, people start exiting and going to the next room, the afterlife. From what she told me, it's like you get to a point when you're older that you start looking at what that other room would be, the afterlife room. And being like, I miss those people. It's not because you don't love the people on earth, but the people you built your life with are no longer here. I've been around so many people who are that age, and a majority of them, they're ready to go see those people again. David says, the in-between also has to do with the experience of being in between uncertainty and knowing. But how much uncertainty is there for you? Because in the book you write about things that you can't explain, like people who are close to death telling you that they're seeing their dead loved ones again. But then you write, I do believe that our loved ones come to get us when we pass. So where is the uncertainty? The uncertainty I have is what after this life looks like. People ask me for those answers, and I don't have them. No one does. I feel like there is something beyond, but I don't know what it is. When people are having these in-between experiences of seeing deceased loved ones, sometimes it's okay to ask what they're seeing. I find that they'll say, oh, I'm going on a trip, or they can't seem to find the words to explain it. So the conclusion I've come to is whatever is next cannot be explained with the language and the knowledge that we have here on earth. Do these experiences feel religious to you? No. And that was one of the most convincing things for me. It doesn't matter what their background is. If they believe in nothing, if they are the most religious person, if they grew up in a different country, rich or poor, they all tell me the same things. And it's not like a dream, which is what I think a lot of people think it is. Like, oh, I went to sleep and I had a dream. What it is instead is this overwhelming series of sense of peace. People feel this peace and they will talk to me just like you and I are talking. And then they'll also talk to their deceased loved ones. I see that over and over again. They're not confused. There's no change in their medications. Other hospice nurses, people who have been doing this longer than me, or physicians, we all believe in this. Do you have a sense of whether emergency room nurses report similar things? I interned in the ER, and the nurse I was shadowing said that no one who works in the ER believes in an afterlife. I asked myself, well, how do I know who's correct? How am I supposed to know? Are the people in the church that I was raised with more correct than all these people? How are you supposed to know what's right and what's not? But you've made a choice about what you believe, so what makes you believe it? I totally get it. People are like, I don't know what you're talking about. So, okay, medically someone's at the end of their life. Many times, not all the time, there will be up to a minute between breaths. That can go on for hours. A lot of times there will be family there and you're pretty much just staring at someone being like, when is the last breath going to come? It's stressful. What is so interesting to me is that almost everyone will know exactly when it's someone's last breath, that moment, not 1 minute later. We're somehow aware that a certain energy is not there. I've looked for different explanations and a lot of the explanations don't match my experiences. David says, that reminds me of how people say someone just gives off a bad vibe. oh, I totally believe in bad vibes. And David says, but I think there must be subconscious cues that we're picking up that we don't know how to measure scientifically. That's different from saying it's supernatural. We might not know why, but there's nothing magic going on. She says, you don't have any kinds of doubts? David says, none. Really? That's so interesting. You know, I read your article with the atheist. I feel like you pushed back on him. And David says, there are so many things in our lives, both on the small and the big scale, that we don't understand. But I don't think that means they're beyond understanding. And she says, okay, you know what you would like? Because I know what you're like. I believe this, but you seem to be very interested. You're not just set in your ways. Have you ever heard that little story about two twins in a womb? I'm going to totally butcher it, but essentially it's two twins who can talk in the womb. One twin is like, I don't think that there is any life after birth. And the other is like, I don't know. I believe that there's something after we're born. Well, no one's ever come back after birth to tell us that there is. I think that there's going to be a world where we can live without the umbilical cord and there's light. What are you talking about? You're crazy. I think about it a lot. Do we just not have enough perspective here to see what would come next? I think you'll like that story. David says, for the dying people who don't experience what you describe, and especially their loved ones, is your book maybe setting them up to think, like, did I do something wrong? Was my faith not strong enough? Well, when I'm in the home, I'll always prepare people for the worst case scenario, which is that sometimes it looks like people might be close to going into a coma and they haven't seen anyone. And the family is extremely religious. I'll talk to them and say, in my own experience, only 30% of people can even communicate to us that they're seeing people. So I try to be with my families and really prepare them for the worst case scenario. But that's something I had to learn over time. Have you thought about what a good death would be for you? I want to be at home. I want to have my immediate family come and go as they want. And I want a living funeral. I don't want people to say, this is my favorite memory of her when I'm gone. Come when I'm dying and let's talk about those memories together. There have been times when patients have shared with me that they just don't think anyone cares about them. Then I'll go to their funeral and listen to the most beautiful eulogies. I believe they can still hear it and aware of it. But I'm also like, gosh, I wish that before they died they heard you say those things. That's what I want. David, you know, I have a really hard time with the supernatural aspects, but I think the work that you do is noble and valuable. There's so much stuff we spend time thinking about and talking about that is less meaningful than what it means for those close to us to die. She says, I have so many people reach out to me who are just like you. I don't believe in the supernatural, but my grandfather went through this, and I appreciate getting more of an understanding. I feel like I'm not alone. Even if they're also like, this is crazy, people being able to feel not alone is valuable. Now I'll read a letter of recommendation. How Mahjong Brought Me Closer to My Mother. A game that bridges continents and generations. This is a story by Rudy Lee. My mother never wanted me to learn how to play Mahjong, fearing it might foster a propensity for gambling. When I was young, though, her sister would visit from London, giving her a sufficient number of players for the game. As dusk settled, I was lured from my bedroom to the table by the shuffling of ivory tiles and clattering of chips after someone yelled, Kong! My mother, as aunts do, made me her proxy, giving me her seat and perching behind me as I played. Her sister acquiesced. In time, my mother taught me the rudiments, a trio of suits with tiles numbered 1 through 9, 4 of each, a quartet of capricious winds, east, south, west, north, 4 of each, and the triumvirate of so-called dragons, you guessed it, 4 of each. The object of the game, reminiscent of gin rummy, involves drawing tiles or taking discards to form sets. Chi, a sequence of 3 tiles from 1 suit, Pong, a trio of identical tiles, and Kong, an elevated Pong, all 4 of any tile. A winning hand, with a couple of exceptions, comprises 4 sets and a pair. My mother will tell you that she's not a gambler, but that's a wily hedge. She zealously plays the stock market, the lottery, and mahjong, a game in which payout grows not just incrementally, but exponentially. She loves to tell the story of how she and her friends back in Kuala Lumpur would play for so long that one of them was wont to turn his underwear inside out so he wouldn't have to stop. When my mother immigrated to Canada in the 1980s, a couple of heirloom mahjong sets were chief among the possessions she brought from Malaysia. As a first-generation kid, I navigated the ragged contours of identity by trying to renounce my ethnicity. I was loath to bring pork floss sandwiches to school, even though I thought they were superior to Lunchables. During the dawn of dial-up internet, I would clandestinely ask Jeeves about double eyelid surgery, as if I could clandestinely undergo such a procedure. I still can't really speak Cantonese, in my defense, neither can my father, in his defense. His native tongue is Hokkien. Before I departed for college, however, I had taken a real shine to the game of mahjong. When I, my parents' only son, left Vancouver for Toronto, my mother suspected I'd never move back. She's right, but what Chinese mother isn't? Her infallibility is at the root of most of our rifts, the most egregious of which stem from squabbles over money. In our family, her misconstruals become the truth. I'm the only one who puts up resistance. But mahjong is where combat, stripped of vitriol, converges harmoniously with the topic of wealth. Together, we play until we can't hold our eyes open. Apart, it's almost exclusively what we text about. Over time, she's disclosed more complexities of play as if she's been hoarding them in order to safeguard some tenuous connection between us. Every new skill I acquired seemed to beget even more intricacies. With a thirst for the game's infinitesimal nuance, I sent for one of the heirloom sets upon relocating stateside. That mutual thirst, it turned out, would tether us across a chasm of continental proportions. As time passes, I've come to realize that most high-scoring combinations in mahjong comprise a single element. An elegant hand, all 1s and 9s, akin to the aces and kings in a deck of cards, a flush of chi, a pong of every wind, is liable to bankrupt one's opponent. Almost everything else yields a much-derided gai, wu, or chicken hand. But there is at least one outlier, the elusive kan-kan-wu. At first blush, it can resemble a gai-wu, but this tactic lies in a consummate maneuver. The player must draw all the tiles they need rather than taking discards. It's a hand of agency, of self-sufficiency, the hand of the migrant's wager. It's also a hand where our disparate personalities intersect. My mother, ever a Pollyanna, favors the Gao Sok tile, a riot of 9 bamboo stalks in ruby and jade, and indigo in some sense. She once observed that the Bang Tung, the monochromatic rectangle of 8 inky circles, dark and understated, is a harbinger of luck for me. She's right. it's no coincidence that its alternate name, Gung Khoi, means coffin, evoking my sense of gallows humor. Kan Kon Wu, with its motley of melds, is where these two tiles from different suits can be used in a clean, sweeping hand. I once read that Kan Kan, a hand whose concord belies its haphazard origins, can mean chaos. Today, the opportunity for me to play with my mother occurs on the rare occasion I visit home. It may seem odd that gambling has brought us closer than ever. Perhaps a sly subversion on my part, but it places notions of money into territory where winnings are ancillary to the pursuit of play. In the wake of our checkered relationship, the most profound fortune is how we've parlayed a wealth-obsessed game, one no less with a tile called the Phoet Khoi, literally get rich, into an invaluable bond. Rudy Lee is a research editor for the magazine. Now I'll read the Screenland section of the magazine. The landlords of social media seem happy to play the villain. Why are property owners on social media crowing about the least lovable parts of their job? It's a story by Michael Fredrich. A trim, bearded landlord stands on the balcony of a high-rise, the Miami skyline extending hazily behind him, and squints into his phone to read a user-submitted question. Have I ever evicted a single mother out of one of my properties? He says, oh yes, on multiple occasions. The man's name is Tom Cruise, and it's spelled C-R-U-Z, and his video recently went viral on TikTok. Guys, there's nobody protected in my portfolio, he explains. The elderly, the disabled, single moms. If he doesn't evict, he reasons, renters won't respect him as a landlord or an investor. He shares the story of a particular problem tenant, Ms. Carla. If you're watching this, sorry, I'm not sorry, he says winkingly. According to Cruz, property manager told him Ms. Carla hadn't paid rent in 2 months, even after multiple warnings. When he checked his records, he found that he had offered to buy her out of the apartment, cash for keys, but she had stopped responding. So he began the process to remove her. 3 weeks later, $200 in legal fees, and she's out on her ass with an eviction on her record. Cruz presents himself as an untroubled pragmatist, tough but fair, who refuses to be misused by tenants or burdened by guilt about their predicaments. In his telling, the housing market is a contest with winners and losers. Everyone plays a game, he says in one video. By his account, he owns more than 650 homes across 4 states in the South and the Midwest, where he rents to low-income people subsidized by Section 8 housing vouchers. The federal government guarantees the rent, and thus a majority of his income, which he says is roughly $1 million per month. Cruz spins these operations into digital content, ranging from tips for aspiring investors to plain old-fashioned yacht-flaunting braggadocio. Tenants play their own games, he warns. Some are frauds who actually own luxury vehicles and fancy jewelry. Others will gladly take advantage of your kindness. You get the sense that he would no sooner go easy on a single mother than a poker player would throw a hand just to be friendly. Business is business. It's no surprise that social media brims over with videos from real estate influencers. What's astonishing is that property owners, landlords, some of the most broadly despised people in the country, are logging on to boast about the most ruthless and loathsome things they do. In one video, the protagonist of an account called Build Wealth with Gustavo laughingly bemoans the damage an evicted resident has done to his house in the hood. Soon, he's transforming it into an attractive $100,000 rehab project. In another, landlord exhibits the nightmare of a rental trailer trashed by tenants, explaining that rents are so high because of people like this. Scroll on, and you might find a maintenance man dancing in the wreckage of an eviction while on-screen text explains his plans to add to the former occupant's debt. So, who really got the last laugh? It reads, alongside a smiley face emoji. I first encountered Cruz's eviction video through an activist repost, accompanied by a two-word caption, "Abolish landlords." But part of the reason landlords create this content in the first place is, it appears, as a way of provoking such critics. Each video forms a rhetorical maneuver designed to cast the "Abolish landlords" set as ignorant of the real world. There's a trollish, deadpan, sorry, not sorry quality in their responses to the inevitable scolding. When, for example, a commenter upbraids Cruz for turning a basic human need into an investment, Cruz doubles down, comparing housing to other profitable essentials like food and water. "I think it's the coolest investment you can make," he says. Housing is certainly one of the easiest markets for ordinary people to enter as owners, but it's also among the most fraught with suffering. Many people decline to rent out their properties precisely to avoid the emotional and legal entanglements that can result, knowing they might lack the stomach to, say, evict a tenant with children. Landlords like Cruz, by contrast, relish playing the villain, at least rhetorically. They depict themselves as tougher than the average person, and therefore richer. Cruz's involvement with evictions, or any interpersonal business with the Ms. Carlas of the world, is presumably remote. Others execute his decisions to remove a tenant. But in the video content, that decision lets him create. But in the video content, that decision lets him create. He is the hard-nosed adult who works, who knows how the world works. And anyone complaining in the comments is an impotent child. The image of the mustache-twirling landlord as villain goes back at least to the Industrial Revolution, when popular culture made the role synonymous with cold-hearted extraction from the poor. These days, however, mainstream media barely depicts landlords at all, despite a wealth of programs about housing. Reality shows like HGTV's Flip or Flop focus on the lucrative hustle to buy, rehab, and sell homes, paying scant attention to who might live in them. Netflix's Selling Sunset function as property porn, emphasizing the pleasures of lush interiors and infinity pools. Such aspirational viewing is almost wholly divorced from the average person's experience of today's rental market, in which rent absorbs an increasing share of income and eviction filings and homelessness continue to rise. One thing you can say for the landlords of TikTok is that they, at least, are talking realistically about American housing. Overheated markets have allowed more small-time investors than ever to snap up properties and aggressively maximize the profit they produce. Cruz is correct. This is a game, in a way, and it's reward, and it rewards those who fashion themselves as mini moguls. Among those influencers, though, quietly maximizing profits does not appear to be enough. In their bravado, you sense a deeper desire for respect. One man patiently explains all the reasons that getting evicted is terrible for your credit and reputation, as though he's issuing a public service announcement. Cruz himself occasionally makes a show of paying tenants' rent. This is the paradox of their unapologetic pose. They play the villain because they want to be like them. Landlords, this is because of their unapologetic pose. They play the villain because they want you to like them. Landlords of this type do little of the labor an ordinary viewer might recognize as useful. They aren't on site making repairs or improvements or building relationships with tenants. If they want to win you to their side, what are their options beyond a one-time rent jubilee? Their best trick is a kind of prosperity gospel, a towering retort to the naive bleeding hearts shouting up at them from the ground floor, flashing their riches and their tough guy mindset. They suggest that they possess the key to thriving in the real world, and that you too could rise to the impervious penthouse of wealth and power if only you let them guide you. In most of Cruz's videos, he dominates the frame. Still, I can't help noticing the background, where a sliver of Miami is often visible, full of construction cranes, high-rises, and public parks. Somewhere out there, you imagine, are political elites, developers, corporate investors, activists, bankers, regulators, all the various forces in a market that is growing more and more brutal for regular people. What's remarkable about these landlords is that within that complex system, they seem to conceive of themselves as regular people too, only they have found a hack, a better way to play the game, a means to benefit instead of being brutalized. Why, they ask, wouldn't you aspire to follow their lead? Why not sign up for their webinar? Have they not, at the very least, earned someone's admiration? I read another letter of recommendation. What I learned about cities from Tony Hawk's Pro Skater. The games remind you of the endless possibilities that they possess, the antithesis of how we have sometimes been encouraged to approach them with caution. It's a story by Jack Sheehan. Sometimes, when I feel sad, I'll watch a 2019 video of Tony Hawk cruising down California streets looking for skaters. When he sees one, he yells, "Do a kickflip!" If they land it, or even if they don't, he gives them a skateboard deck or some merch and maybe a fist bump. I don't own a skateboard, and the only place I can do a kickflip is in the 1999 video game Tony Hawk's Pro Skater. But I can still feel a little of the joy of those skateboarders. The premise of the game is simple. You take control of one of a selection of professional skaters like Bob Burnquist, Alyssa Steamer, or Hawk himself, and try to land a series of increasingly difficult tricks in environments inspired by skating hotspots like Portland's Burnside Skate Park and San Francisco's Valancourt Fountain. But real-world skaters transformed suburban and urban corners into sporting havens. The Tony Hawk games rendered them as skating fantasy lands. Released at a moment when skateboarding was beginning to go mainstream, THPS became popular because it invited skaters and non-skaters alike to feel the thrill of getting air, doing a kick flip, or landing a trick by the thinnest margin. Its aesthetic and soundtrack, punk, hip-hop, ska, granted access to a countercultural space that still feels dangerous, not yet totally absorbed into American consumerism. Growing up in suburban Dublin, I felt an instinctive kinship with American skate culture. After all, skaters had emerged from dull commuter belts of their own and worked together to turn their cities and towns into sites of play. The original games demonstrated an obvious love for that culture, the clothes, the language, the music. outside the confines of their digital playgrounds. The game and its sequels carried the promise that My Suburbia could be exciting, too. The cheap construction materials and bland functional architecture that made certain cities and suburbs feel so similar to one another also allowed a kind of cultural affinity. Through beige cladding, concrete stair sets, brushed chrome railings, and rickety plywood ramps, Ventura, California, and my own anodyne Leopard's Town in Ireland became related versions of one another, thousands of miles apart. Play THPS long enough, and you'll notice your perspective on reality changes. My brain instinctively looks for good rails to grind, places I could get air or make a slick transition, even though I'll most likely never do any of those things. When I was a kid, it made me appreciate the unloved corners of where I came from, the industrial estate, the underground parking lot, the no man's land beneath a bridge or beside a train station. Video games are full of secret areas, and so is our physical world. In 2020, the game developer Vicarious Visions released a remastered version of the first two Tony Hawk games. The makers had updated THPS for modern machines, bolting snazzy new lighting, textures, and physics onto the old skeleton. After I came down with COVID, April 2022, I holed up alone in my apartment, and for 6 days, I did little else but virtually skate. To my surprise, I could still flawlessly tail slide the Venice ledge, find all the collectible items, and win gold at Marseille. Paradoxically, the remake feels more faithful to the original games than it really is. Instead of replicating how the games were, the developers recreated how I remember them. It's as if they found my fuzzy memories of their beautiful toy box skate parks and cities. Watching clips of the Venice Beach level in the original version on YouTube, I saw that the zone was flatly lit, oddly empty, made of wobbly 90s polygons. With the remake, I see the Southern California of my dreams, a golden playground on the beach, all intricate graffiti and evocative Western architecture. In real life, skating is an art form that requires constant sacrifice, physical pain, and public embarrassment for the sake of an ephemeral few seconds of pure beauty. You have to fail 1,000 times before you succeed. The Tony Hawk games aren't concerned with that. They recreate the iterative satisfaction of skating, the feeling that with enough practice, you can do something miraculous without all the concussions, bloody knees, and shattered wrists. The games also remind you of the endless possibilities that cities possess, the antithesis of how we have sometimes been encouraged to approach them with caution. Skating shows us another path. It allows us to see cities as social spaces, zones of exciting risk. A nondescript alien piece of concrete can become a hollowed skate spot, a place to meet, take chances, and store memories. I'll probably never learn how to do a kickflip in real life, but when I play THPS, I let the strains of Goldfinger's Superman wash over me as I spend a few hours inside a fantasy city. I ollie, bail, go again. Makes me look at my home differently. It reminds me of the places out there in the world yet to be discovered, the tricks yet to be attempted, and the chance, however faint, of one day landing them. Jack Sheehan is a writer and historian from Dublin, Ireland. I'll read another Screenland from a previous issue. Why people love to watch influencers get punched in the face. When celebrities face off in the boxing ring, their number of Instagram followers or lucrative brand deals can't help them. Only fists prevail. It's a story by Brady Brickner Wood. Early in September, when the social media star Logan Paul and the mixed martial arts welterweight Dylan Danis sat down for an interview in advance of their October 14th boxing match, they seemed like less like professional athletes and more like high school bullies vying to supplant each other in popularity. It wasn't just the mini mullets or the cocky schoolboy grins. It was the second-rate insults and personal attacks that ping-ponged back and forth. Mr. Mumble-jumble stumble his way through a sentence. Paul taunted when Danis tripped over his words. Danis repeated ad nauseum, "You're a scumbag, bro." The hate between these two is real. Danz, the streaming service set to air the fight, declared, "This was the central narrative promoting the match. In lieu of top talent or actual competitive stakes, things began with Danis and Paul's celebrity and operatic rivalry. Maybe that would attract hundreds of thousands of viewers and tens of millions of dollars to an otherwise middling boxing match." It's mostly just the allure of realism that distinguishes the bout from the average World Wrestling Entertainment broadcast. Paul, in fact, performs for WWE on a part-time basis. There's all the cartoonish chest-puffing and narrative building of pro wrestling, but instead of scripted outcomes and choreographed body slams, fighters like these two are eventually required to square off without staging or intervention. The publicity may be strained and the plot spurious, but in the ring, there's no hiding from the reality of a jab, a cross, blood leaking from a swollen eye. Boxing satisfies a basic comparative and competitive instinct. It's this guy versus that guy with only their gloved fists, not their number of Instagram followers or lucrative brand deals at their disposal. There's poetry in how plainly human the whole thing is. But the poetry of the bout itself doesn't always sell pay-per-view packages. These days, many of the sport's most popular fights don't feature world champions or rising talents. They feature social media influencers and retired but still famous boxers pining for a paycheck. What's more entertaining, the bantamweight world title match or a rock-bottom 2021 squabble between the retired NBA player Lamar Odom and the former child star Aaron Carter? An 8-round heavyweight qualifier or watching the family vlogger Austin McBroom knock out the TikTok frat bro Bryce Hall? In 2020, a friendly face-off between two middle-aged legends, Mike Tyson and Roy Jones Jr., drew massive viewership because, well, it was Mike Tyson. Floyd Mayweather Jr. has spent his post-retirement life showing up to novelty exhibitions for eight-figure sums. And who among us wouldn't consider tuning in to that much-discussed Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk cage match? These fights garner interest because of their characters, not their quality. This is the world of influencer boxing, of internet famous tough guys and celebrities clinging to relevance, of manufactured beefs and emotional arcs plotted via training videos and podcast appearances. Influencer boxers know something boxing purists don't, that a fight without a narrative, no matter how poetic its execution, is just a hollow technical exercise. Boxing promoters have spent decades enticing viewers with the prospect of seeing celebrities in the ring. In 1991, when the former NFL All-Pro Mark Gastineau became a professional fighter, a popular figure suddenly competing in a very new context, his career attracted national interest. 60 Minutes later reported that most of his fights were fixed, with opponents paid to take dives. The appeal of familiar faces in violent battles emerged in fiction, too, as with Celebrity Deathmatch, which debuted in 1998 and featured stop-motion animations of celebrities killing each other in the ring. In 2002, Fox ran two episodes of Celebrity Boxing, starring the likes of Vanilla Ice and Tonya Harding, before canceling it. TV Guide would later rank it the sixth worst show ever. That same year, Donald Trump's Atlantic City Casino hosted the Brawl at the Taj Mahal, a stunt fight between two regulars on Howard Stern's radio show. Such spectacles may not have the craft of top-tier boxing, but they capitalize on a powerful force, the desperate demeanor of people prepared to do anything to grow or maintain their fame. Logan Paul and his younger brother, Jake Paul, seem to understand the power of narrative better than their peers. Jake is a Disney Channel actor turned YouTuber turned rapper. Logan is a YouTuber turned podcaster turned energy drink salesman. Each began boxing in 2018. Since then, Logan has lost to Mayweather in a widely publicized exhibition match, while Jake has landed among the most recognized names in boxing, cultivating the image of a renegade disrupting the sport. Hardly matters to viewers that the Pauls are top-tier self-promoters, but at best, mid-tier boxers. What matters is their flair for the dramatic and their internet-bred ability to get people to care about them. In every other professional sport, major events promise elite performance first and then search for narratives to enliven them. The record-setting ratings at this year's U.S. Open tennis final between Coco Gauff and Erna Sablenka, for instance, owed something to Gauff's irresistible ascension and charisma, but they were earned mostly by the otherworldly talent on display. Yet in boxing, there's no longer a discernible marriage between talent and narrative. To care about the fight between Paul and Dennis, or one between the rapper Blueface and the TikToker Ed Matthews, or the retired NFL star Le'Veon Bell and the YouTuber JMX, is to care almost exclusively about the caricatures these figures present. There are no real athletic stakes, no championship belt to be lifted. The match's meaning is derived almost solely from its plotting. Boxing, as a mainstream entertainment, the stuff of front pages and towering athletes, had its peak in the 20th century. Now, increasingly, it's a niche product, not a mass market one. As the combat sports journalist Ariel Helwani said in an episode of Netflix's Untold documentary series spotlighting Jake Paul, "I can't tell you just how hard it is to get people to be emotionally invested, to get people to care, to get people to buy pay-per-views and tickets. But there is a robust new audience that follows social media celebrities and would not mind watching them duke it out. If nothing else, the Pauls know how to curry that attention." Before pivoting to boxing, Logan was perhaps best known for posting a video of a body hanging from a tree in Japan's suicide forest, a stunt that spawned outrage and led YouTube to suspend his ad revenue. Somehow he emerged from the controversy more famous than ever, reinforcing a sinister lesson about content creation. Do whatever it takes to maximize engagement. Like YouTube and brand ambassadorships, boxing is a good platform for languishing in a state of demi-celebrity where neither elite talent nor ethics is a prerequisite. It's no wonder the Pauls fit in. Dennis, for his part, is a perfect partner. And the build-up to his fight with Logan, he's posted pornographic video supposedly featuring Paul's fiance, the model Nina Agdal, and devoted his social media to shaming her. She's gotten a restraining order. Paul, meanwhile, has called Danis's mother an actual prostitute. Here, it seems, are the bullies yapping about their fight in the parking lot and persuading their peers, against their better judgment, to gawk at whoever raises his arms in triumph. I'll read a couple of Judge John Hodgman. And this is Judge John Hodgman on the soup debate. Paul writes, "I'm the cook in our house. As summer turns to fall, I like to make hearty soups. But my wife contends that soup is not a dinner food unless she's sick. I say this is absurd." And the judge writes, "Your wife can always make her own prime rib or pheasant under glass or whatever. Those are definitely capital D dinners. But while she may be underappreciative, she isn't wrong. I love all soup, apart from the crime of Manhattan clam chowder. It obviously has a place at the Western dinner table, along with its old buddy nuts. But to my mind, it shouldn't. Soup is nourishing in a singular way, partly because it's so slurpy and personal. It's perfect for a solo lunch or late-night inhalation at the ramen bar. I'll grant it even makes a good light supper with some crusty bread. If your marriage is at the empty nest seated side by side while re-watching Mad Men stage like mine. But if you can't put a fork in it, dinner isn't done. Try getting into stew." And one more Judge John Hodgman on the curse of the sourdough starter. "It inspired a bread dough making frenzy and took over this couple's fridge." Andrew writes, "My husband was gifted a sourdough starter established in the 1890s by a stranger in the forest. He's filled our refrigerator with dough, but hasn't baked any of it. I demand the fridge back." And the judge writes, "First of all, don't accept food, never mind ancient yeast colonies, from strangers in the woods. But it's too late for that. Your husband has been cursed by a bread fairy and is now bound to keep making dough until the spell is lifted. And because no one wants that stuff since the glut of 2020, there's only one choice. You must bake all that bread yourself, then walk through the woods, leaving a trail of crumbs behind you until all of it is gone. If a golden swan follows you home, though, don't let it in. It's a Wordle witch. As for the starter, read this column over it while making eye contact with your partner, and you'll discover he will magically knock it off." Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.